Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis, and on our best days, some insight into the news media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, the editor of the Times Union, and I am happy to be with you today, along with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio himself.
Hi, everybody, no matter when you're listening to this program.
Yes, no matter when. It's a great thing. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist and professor. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and now vice president of the New York Press Association.
I am happy to be here as well, always.
Always. Judy, Rosemary, Alan, and Rex, and we are here thanks to our producer, David Gustina, who is making sure that we have interesting things to talk about, as always, which is kind of an important element. And our listeners also send us your thoughts. media@wamc.org, and we have one here from a listener, Jacqueline, who says, "Dear Alan, hey, what about the rest of us here?
Well, just suffer."
Dear Alan, the demise of small newspapers is often talked about in terms of local events and lack of obituaries, but more serious is the lack of coverage of local board meetings and the ability of the press to bear witness. We end up with shenanigans and cover-ups, board minutes that knowingly do not reflect what actually occurs, and a public that doesn't know it. So, is not that true? It is true.
Yeah, absolutely. But you have to have a sense of the sheer number of local governments out there, from towns to villages to cities. And even within cities and towns, you have recreation commissions. You have innumerable municipal entities that we used to cover. And we used to get really good stories out of them and really hold people to account if they're going to start charging more for the summer rec program, or if the contract for a certain paving job is going to one company more often than it should. All that has disappeared. It's true. And it's a crying shame. You'll see newspapers drop in if they get wind of something big. If somebody tips off the local paper, then they'll swoop in and do like a one-shot story. My hope is at least maybe those tips will keep coming in, and that, you know, citizens will go out there, go to meetings. And it has all along been a shame that the reporter is the only one at these meetings. Now I think real people need to go to these meetings too and participate in government.
Real people, I like that. Yeah, it's differentiated from reporters. Yeah.
You know, and I've mentioned this before, but we have reporters all over the place. And when we do a story that is significant in one place, we'll sometimes hear from somebody else who'll say, "Hey, what are you boring us with that stuff for?" Because that's our job. That's why. You know, over in the Berkshires right now, there's a big controversy. Andrea Harrington, who is the elected district attorney, but who was not supported by the Berkshire Eagle when she ran, is in a bit of a mess in that Simon's Rock College of Bard had an alleged incident in which a student said she was attacked in the woods at Simon's Rock. Well, the state police came in. Everybody else came in. They were very sensitive about it. Turns out that all of them said there was no proof that anything ever happened. Now, this happens from time to time. We saw it with Tawana Brawley. We saw it with the people on the bus at SUNY at Albany. And so it happens. The newspaper comes along and says, "We want all the information, and we want you to give us the stuff." And the DA said, "Nothing doing. There's privacy involved here and the rest." And so the Berkshire Eagle, which had not supported Harrington in the first place, has done editorials, there are letters that show up supporting their position. And I don't know that anybody can ever win a fight like that, even if the newspaper is wrong, which happens from time to time. The newspapers do make mistakes.
Mm-hmm. And so they are looking for essentially what would have been the evidence, or what led the DA to the decision that there was no crime, in fact.
I really don't know what they were looking for. Hmm. Perhaps there was some confidentiality about what the name of the student was.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that newspapers have great amounts of power.
Hmm.
And if that power is exercised, as we have all seen, no matter what you guys are going to tell me, if that power is exercised in a way which is not a good way of exercising power, if it's personal animus, there can be real bad trouble.
I think that's absolutely right. That's why you hope that you have an informed citizenry that will hold the press to account as well as the public officials whom the press is holding to account.
Is that your experience? That happens, that people ever hold the newspaper to?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get you an amazing amount of feedback that I get.
Well, you know, it's somebody calling you or writing you is one thing, but, you know, huge popular outrage, I think, is not seen a lot.
Well, I would hope that what we do is fair and honest enough so that huge popular outrage is not warranted. I haven't seen huge popular outrage about our coverage because I don't know of anything that we did that warranted that.
The truth is that when newspapers screw up, they do a harder job than anybody at punishing themselves. And I'll refer you to Jason Blair, the fabulous plagiarist from the New York Times. And there were 8 full pages on a major investigation of what went wrong.
Yeah, well, that's a good example.
It's better than a prosecutor.
Well, that's a good example. However, that was so outrageous that, of course, they were caught. They got caught with their pants down.
They caught themselves.
They caught themselves, yeah. Yes. They did not. It was not public outrage that went after them.
Right. You think there was, even after they did what they did, you know, in terms of firing them and everything else, you think that there was proper public outrage?
It was the opposite of outrage. Outrage would have been good. The public should have been outraged for what happened. Instead, they went back and people said, oh, yeah, we knew it wasn't true. We just figured it was a mistake in the newspaper. There was this great acceptance of sloppy, made-up work. And that, to me, is worse than public outrage. Outrage is a form of being engaged with the media, which we don't have.
Yeah.
Could use some of it.
Interesting. There isn't as much engagement. We used to bemoan the engagement, and now I feel as though sometimes we don't have as much because people are tuning out, mm-hmm. except for, of course, their own preferred channels. People watch Fox and feel good about what they watch and hear on Fox, or people feel the same way about their MSNBC. But there isn't as much actual citizen engagement with the media as there used to be because people are withdrawing into their shells. I think citizens are just not as actively involved.
Or to their camps. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Our producer, our wonderful producer, David Gustino, pointed out that fewer people were watching the beginnings of the impeachment trial than were tuning in at the beginning of the impeachment hearings. Now, my take on that is that the hearings offered two sides. You had the Democrats bringing up evidence, and you had the Republicans combating that evidence. Here, I have a feeling that some people are tuning out until their team gets their ups, and then they tune in.
Right.
We should know that the Fox News channel had the highest viewership, but if you went to Fox News to try to watch this, all they had was a box with the hearing happening, but you couldn't hear any sound. It was just a visual while the regular programming was going on. So these mm-hmm. people weren't even watching the impeachment trial. Fox was just throwing a little bit of visual into the mix.
In fact, on Tucker Carlson's 8 p.m. show, there he was doing his talking points while there was a banner, a font over Hakeem Jeffries, the congressman, while he was speaking, "Dems push hysterical talking points at trial," it said. Rather than coverage, Fox is giving you the right-wing talking points. I don't think hysterical talking points at all accurately describes what I've heard in listening. I mean, any kind of a fair assessment of what was being done is that they weren't hysterical talking points. But that's not what Fox is about, of course.
Well, I agree with you, Rex. I think that's exactly right. I have some colleagues who disagree with me about this, but I think Adam Schiff standing up there for 2.5 hours with a couple of notes in front of him showing what a great orator can be and pulling it all together was an extraordinary experience. I just couldn't wait to see what he was going to do.
Yeah.
The good news is if you added up all the millions of people watching the impeachment hearings on other channels, it was a substantial number of people. It's not nothing.
But it wasn't 13 million. It was 11 million. That's a big difference.
It is true. But people have jobs. But
they didn't have jobs when the impeachment hearing started. In other words,
back in November.
Yes.
But of course,
that's what it was new and different and exciting. And this is going to be long and drawn out. Even under McConnell's cut it to the bone plan, it's still talking 3 to 5 weeks. People figure, why do I have to see it at the beginning? I'll catch it later. And the Democratic managers are actually planning it that way. Jason Crow was talking about how, yes, it will seem repetitive to anybody who sits like us and watches it hour after hour. But it's planned so that they're bringing up the same points over and over again, knowing that people are cutting in and out. It's like the CNN loops.
Mm-hmm. You know, if I was a history professor, American history professor, or teaching high school, I would certainly want a good deal of what has been brought up about the framers of the Constitution and what they meant and what they were, where they were going and how they anticipated this very thing. I think it's a great story about American government.
You know, I was worried about the single camera situation, but the Democrats have used video clips to great effect.
This brilliant.
It has really animated the presentation in a way I didn't think would happen.
I was really surprised, in fact, that the rules that McConnell allows are implemented allow for the full screen takeover by those videos. That is, if you're watching at home, you don't just get the screen behind the speaker playing these videos. It actually takes over your TV screen, and that makes it a much better viewing experience.
Well, it also brings witnesses into a trial that I think we will not have witnesses at.
Interesting. So. What is also intriguing, speaking of the power of Fox News, is the extent to which the president's team echoes Fox News talking points, including those that are not true. You know, you have the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, saying, you know, not even Mr. Schiff's Republican colleagues were allowed into the SCIF, that is the secure compartmentalized, sensitive compartmentalized information facility. Well, that's not true. There were a lot of Republicans in that closed door in the SCIF earlier.
And he got called out for it, by the way.
Well, I hope so.
But not on Fox News.
Not on Fox News.
And also not by the Chief Justice, too. I mean, the whole trial, the media is limited in this because it's being so orchestrated by Senate Republicans, and the Chief Justice is not acting like the judge in a trial.
And can I just say how horrible it is to see the media in the pen like they are?
That's ridiculous.
I get sick to my stomach every time I see the senators walking by, and I see people, you know, restrained like they are, trying to do their job and reaching out like, I don't know, sycophants.
The reporters are complaining that even in the middle of an interview, they've had policemen come up and say, behind the rope, you know, and you have to, they interrupt an interview with an actual senator or a staffer.
It is kind of an amazing situation, and yet it isn't called out. And because of the, let's say, the loss of public support for institutions in general, but the media as well, Americans don't seem to be upset when their representatives, that would be the media, when we are restrained, when we are held back. There doesn't seem to be a public outrage about the fact that reporters are penned in or coverage is withheld.
We are not seen as the people's representatives, and the Republicans have been very effective at painting this. We are players, and we're on the Democratic side. And so if you like the Democratic side, you tend to be positive towards the press. Otherwise,
except if you're Fox or the New York Post.
Although and even them.
But did you watch the senators who know they want that TV time or that air time, and so they'll trot over and when it's at their convenience. But if they don't want to talk, they don't talk. And journalism's position has always been people elected to office have a responsibility to talk to their constituents via the press.
Part of the job.
People have said that. Public officials have said that for years, but you don't find that as much, right? Even in any corner of government now, there seems to be no sense that a public official owes anybody an accounting. And as we were describing, the decline of authority, the decline of the reach even of the media, means that there are fewer people able to keep track of what's going on.
An excellent point.
Well, that's glum. Here's another little bit of glum news. The Tribune Company, which owns a lot of powerful newspapers, starting with the Chicago Tribune, now is on the verge of being taken over by Alden Capital, this hedge fund, New York-based hedge fund that is known for slashing jobs, sucking up short-term profits, leaving ghost newspapers in its wake. Alden Capital, which owns some newspapers in the WAMC immediate listening area, including the papers in Troy, Saratoga Springs, Ira Fussfeld's former newspaper in Kingston, New York. Now they are taking over Tribune with its stable of newspapers. And journalists at the Chicago Tribune are fighting back. They are trying to stop them by publishing their own material, actually an op-ed warning about the pernicious influence of Alden. I wonder if it will do any good.
This is such a storied newspaper. I love the fact that one of the things they can claim credit to is endorsing Abraham Lincoln when he ran for president, and they noted at the time that he was a subscriber to the paper. You got to keep that one going.
Rex, I'm not familiar enough with all of this, but Do they, in fact, call the shots in terms of the political orientation of the various papers they own?
Well, many of the papers simply eliminate the opinion pages, so there is no political orientation. And they have so gutted them that basically there are a couple of local stories in each issue of the paper, but most of it is then wire stuff that is inserted by the people who lay out the paper in some distant city. So I don't think that the concern about Alden Capital is calling the political shots, plays on the editorial page, as much as it is just gutting the journalism so that the communities don't really have good coverage. Imagine if Chicago, now the third largest city in the country, has just a shell of a newspaper with no effective press coverage. What's going to happen there? We may hope that what would happen, just to answer my own question, would be the rise of neighborhood reporting, the rise of small independent voices that would at least have an influence in their local communities. But I don't know that we've seen that happen in other places.
We haven't seen it any place, really. And especially that's a troublesome in Chicago, which is storied, especially, Judy, in investigative reporting. Some of the absolute major corruption reporting in this country has been done at the Chicago Tribune, not recently.
Right. They had a lot
long
to work
time.
With.
Yeah, they had a lot to look at. A very corrupt place in Illinois. And that's not done at the neighborhood level. That's done by your best journalists, your highest paid journalists. And they will no longer be working in Chicago.
So, Rex, one of your duties as editor has been being the budgeter, the guy who has to come up with a budget.
Sorry,
and
did Judy, I groan out loud?
Too, right?
It is the absolute worst part of the job.
Yes, but so your priority is to please your bosses to some degree, right? It has to be. We have to keep the price of what it's costing us to publish this paper down. And in some cases, that means firing reporters, right? And in some cases, it means finding cheaper columnists than others. And I don't know.
Well, certainly we've had to cut spending as the revenues for media outlets have diminished. I think that is well documented. And in a couple of weeks, I'm giving up the role of editor, taking a part-time role as editor at large.
Say it ain't true, Rex.
And it's a great thing to no longer be the one who's going to have to make some of these tough prioritization decisions. You know, where do you cut? I've tried to protect the reporting staff, but the result is that the people who actually put the paper together, the people who paginate and edit the content, are just stretched very thin. I've reduced the number of photographers, and the result is that some days stuff just visually doesn't get covered in order, again, to protect the number of reporters on the beat. These are really tough decisions. You have to figure out how to allocate a reduced pool of money. And I think every editor in the country is facing that. I was talking a few years ago to an editor in Oneonta, I believe, who had five reporters left on his staff. And he recounted how one called in sick, was one was working on a Sunday story, and what they were doing. And he basically had nobody to cover the news of the day. And I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm speaking to you from the roof of the building here. I said, no, don't go. Don't do it. But at these smaller outlets, especially, it's more problematic there even than at a paper the size of mine. I used to be the editor in Troy, you know, and at that time I had 38 people in the newsroom. And now I believe there might be a half dozen. Maybe not. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you try to cope with it, but you feel sympathy for these people at the Tribune papers, and hats off to them for being brave enough to publish in their own paper, as the Denver Post did, columns, op-eds, deriding their soon-to-be bosses.
How long did that last to the Denver Post?
Yeah, not long. Those people no longer there, and the Denver Post is a shell of its former self.
You know, you and Judy once gave me a lesson in something called the slot.
The slot.
And we see that in some newspapers there are mistakes that get made because there isn't anybody to correct them. Is that one of the great problems we have now?
Well, yeah, let's sing the praises of the copy editor for a minute, because they're unsung heroes. People don't see the work that they do, but they often take a reporter's rough copy, which a reporter's copy, I mean, God bless them, but sometimes their copy is rough, and they turn it into pretty good prose. And, you know, the MBA types that are above us in the publishing world, they don't recognize the value that they bring to the paper. They also bring knowledge and a wealth of context that especially less experienced reporters don't have.
Yeah. The slot is the person who allocates the stories, who passes them out for the different copy editors to read them, who then is the final read on them. We've tried innovations like going slotless, going without such a person to be sort of the traffic cop. But it is a difficult job because, as Judy says, you need somebody who understands the community, who can tell that when you say in Albany, Clinton Avenue and Clinton Street are not the same thing, that in Troy, you know, Fifth Avenue becomes Fifth Street when you get up to Lansingburg. These are the kinds of things that local editors will understand and will fix in copy. And if they're not there, readers will notice.
That's true. That's what's happened to a lot of credibility for newspapers, too. Small mistake, with seemingly small mistakes like that, readers not only notice, but they say, well, if they got that wrong, how do I trust them on anything else?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And historical memory is so important. The idea that you know something happened 10 years ago or 5 years ago, and you get a kid out of college, and they don't have that. And who's going to give it to them?
Well, I mean, speaking of college, I'm now working again at the university, so I'm seeing the kids going into the system. And, I mean, this is decades now of decline. And you see it, the newspapers cannot offer money, jobs for one thing, or security, or money. And so fewer and fewer good people are going into the field. You end up with reporters who are more likely to turn in that rough copy you have, and you can't afford to hire people to correct them and to teach them.
Do you
and
tell
on
them
top
that?
Of that, yeah, I do. I think it's very depressing. We have to find a new way, and we haven't yet. We've been bemoaning this for, as I said, at least 25 years I've been talking this way. And then because of, in the name of money, we've lost the very things that made newspapers most worth looking at. And those are local columnists and obituaries and editorial cartoonists. And it's across the whole country. Are newspapers worth saving? Is that Tribune that we have now? Is that worth saving?
Good question. What do you get out of this? Now, there are new forms of communication that are rising. You know that we are going to have to develop greater skill in storytelling. If your audience is digital, you need to be presenting it digitally. If your audience even, I would say, is on Instagram, where you can't actually link to a story, you need to tell a story in visual short clips that is Instagram ready. You know, one of the ethical challenges of journalism is that you need to make your content accessible to the audience. It does you no good to do a 3,000-word story filled with technical jargon if it can't be understood by your readers. And so this challenge that I think the next generation of journalists faces, that some of us our age are probably ill-equipped to teach, is how do you reach people who aren't accustomed to reading deep, who haven't paid attention to local news, or who don't believe that part of their civic responsibility is knowing about this? That's a real challenge that we haven't yet figured out, I think.
That's a really good point. And I'm not sure that I've ever seen it any place that deep stories, deep complicated stories are covered in a way that young people read them. They're just not reading them.
Yeah. And yet they are very important as part of the watchdog responsibility.
Exactly.
You know, when you try to analyze whether public subsidies for private projects like tax breaks to build a hotel, whether you would write to try to analyze whether that is worthwhile public expenditure or not, that's kind of complex to analyze. But it explains where your tax dollars go. And so if you are saying that that's where your tax dollars are going instead of to building affordable housing, these are choices that voters ought to make in a democracy. But if people aren't paying attention to the news coverage that backs that up, or if we are unable to deliver news coverage in a way that people want to access it, then we're not able to do the job.
And you're seeing the result now in a full circle where you have citizens who do not realize, for example, that if Trump were to be removed, Pence would be his replacement, not Nancy Pelosi. I mean, come on.
You know, and we get letters every single day on our panel, which are, to put it mildly, naive.
Yeah.
In terms of people making stuff up about what they think would happen if there was an impeachment. You're so right.
Yeah, would Nancy Pelosi, or some people even, I was watching a story about this, some people think it would be Hillary Clinton would come back in.
Yeah.
What?
And somebody, we think it's possible it may be, you know, a foreign country is putting out a story that Nancy Pelosi's son, Paul Pelosi, is going to be, and it was on NPR as we speak, and people believe it is going to be given major responsibility.
It's all connected. We bemoan the loss of civics in many schools, and that's true, but who would teach the civics? young people who go to college who are not reading newspapers because they're not existing in the way they used to. So it's just all tangled, and I don't see an easy fix here.
You know, I think podcasts are doing a little bit of this to some extent. I find they can dive deep into a topic and deliver a good experience, especially for young people. The New York Times tried this with its editorial decision on endorsing a Democratic candidate in the primaries with a reality TV show, which I think got fairly good reviews. So I think the big guys, the people with a lot of resources, are able to experiment this way. The local people, the small papers, they just don't have the time, they don't have the resources, and they actually don't even have the energy sometimes to tackle this kind of approach.
Yeah. Okay, I hate to close.
Oh, dear.
Lord.
This was a downer.
What a downer of a show. Folks, help us out here. media@wamc.org. Give us some thoughts about how we can sustain good journalism in a difficult time.
I just want to say, Rex, 25 years you've been at the helm of this program, and we all appreciate it, and we sure hope you'll continue to do it.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. I really appreciate
that. That's what people say about me. Very kind.
All right. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Arameo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments. She stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.